Welcome aboard. We will be your guides during this magical journey into the movies. It's the perfect job for us because we love the movies. It's showtime. Ready when you are, CB.
Action.
Welcome to Monorail Radio, episode number 276. I'm Sean.
And I'm Jackie.
And we are here this week to review and discuss the Race to Witch Mountain as it celebrates its 15th anniversary.
You know, Herbie the Love Bug is also celebrating its 55th anniversary this week, and I'm wondering why we picked this over that.
I'm not so sure. Was that a mistake? That's going to get answered later on. Well, you know what I think? Here's the thing. Like, the Witch Mountain franchise is a really interesting one because Herbie the Love Bug is timeless. Some of the sequels are a lot of fun. Some of them, whoa. Witch Mountain, though, is, I feel like, an underappreciated franchise. The first one was a big hit for Disney. We talked about it. I'll link that episode in the show notes. And this seems to be one that kind of, like, comes and goes, and they try to remake it, and they try to reboot it, and then it goes dormant, and they try it again. There's this bizarre little engine that could thing that is happening right now with Witch Mountain and Disney, which kind of has been its entire lifespan. I feel like they keep trying with it.
I'm still not past you calling it a franchise.
Well, I feel like they try to make it one.
Well, I mean, why wouldn't you? It was based on a book, so if they have the rights to the book, we know Disney's going to cash in on it for all it's worth.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is kind of interesting because you and I had very mixed reviews when we did Escape to Witch Mountain, which we actually landed on in a Monorail Radio roulette, which we've not done in a really long time. They're coming back, we promise. We're going to do them eventually. We completely stumbled upon it at random, and I remember really liking the way that it was shot because, you know, there was a lot that was filmed on the Pacific Coast Highway. A lot of the practical effects were really cool, but I also remember liking it a lot less story-wise as we talked about it on the show.
Yeah, I think I was a little kinder to it than
you were. Definitely more forgiving than I was.
But where do we land on this one? Does this need the same level of forgiveness? Did we swing and miss by talking about this as opposed to Herbie the Love Bug? That, on top of many other things, is what we are here to discuss today.
This episode is sponsored by Fierce Fox Co., designers of handmade silkscreen shirts. Fierce Fox has a t-shirt, tank top, hoodie, or crew neck for every fandom. So whether it's the movies or theme parks, princesses or villains, the MCU or Star Wars, everyone will find something they love. The designs range from subtle quotes from our favorite films to iconic characters we can wear proudly in so many different styles, such as sketchbook and concert tees. Listeners of Monorail Radio can get a 20% discount using the code Monorail at checkout. Visit FierceFoxDesignCo.com to check out all of the collections.
An alien craft crash lands in the desert outside of Las Vegas and is pursued by the government. We meet frustrated cab driver Jack Bruno as he drives Dr. Alex Friedman, a discredited astrophysicist, to a UFO convention. The next day, when Jack picks up his cab, he sees two kids, Sarah and Seth. They have apparently appeared in the cab with a wad of cash and start directing him to their desired coordinates. He has no idea, by the way, that they are aliens disguised as teenagers. Using surveillance cameras, the authorities track them to Vegas and go there to capture them. As they drive through the desert, the men of Mr. Wolf, a former associate of Jack's, pursues them. However, Seth uses his powers to allow himself to be hit by a car. However, he destroys the car and stands his ground, unbeknownst to Jack, who simply thinks that the kids are runaways. Jack drops the kids in the middle of nowhere, but goes to find them when he becomes guilty of the very large tip that they left him. He follows them into an old shack, which turns out to be an underground lab holding a living organism that Seth and Sarah have come to Earth to find. They are attacked by the Siphon, an alien assassin, who is also pursuing the organism, but eventually escape and expose their powers to Jack. The authorities learn Jack's been helping the kids, and we learn that he was once an aspiring NASCAR driver who became a getaway driver for Mr. Wolf, who is also in the Mafia. The trio get to a diner where the authorities find them and offer to wipe Jack's criminal record clean in exchange for the kids. However, they are able to escape after the government officials and local sheriff pull guns on each other. As they escape, they find an aggressive dog who they later name Junkyard, who takes a liking to Sarah. Needing help getting their ship back from the authorities, they turn to Alex at the convention. The kids explain that their planet 3,000 light years away is dying, and despite major opposition, their planet will invade Earth to survive. Their parents are scientists who believe that the planet can be saved without invasion, but are arrested before completing their research. The Siphon was sent to stop them, so they need to defeat him, retrieve their ship, and return with their findings to save both planets. With help from Dr. Harlan, they learn that the ship is being kept inside a government base on Witch Mountain. They head there only to be captured. The authorities plan to dissect the kids for research and release Jack and Alex, as no one would believe them. They eventually break free and head back to Witch Mountain and save Seth and Sarah from experimentation, and find their ship after the Siphon arrives and begins to attack the soldiers guarding the base. They narrowly escape Witch Mountain and kill the Siphon. The kids give Alex and Jack a tracking device for future contact. Jack promises to look after Junkyard and is given telekinetic powers by Sarah. Seth and Sarah return home, and Jack and Alex go public with the Witch Mountain story and find success and credibility. It's really straightforward.
It really is. Off top, though, I feel like this was such a 90s thing. And we just talked about that this is celebrating its 15th anniversary. So it's 2009, right? But I feel like that was such a 90s thing of, we're going to remake a film. How do we make it more contemporary? I got it. Vegas. So many films were repackaged as a modern remake simply by switching the setting to Vegas. But I think that did really work in this case, because if you're talking about aliens, of course you're thinking, you know, Area 51. And I like how they set it up in the opening credits by showing both sides of the coin. They're showing all of these news articles of UFO sightings cut against like government cover up. So I thought that that was a really good way to establish that we are playing both sides here.
I thought the intro was excellent. I thought it was quickly paced. I thought it introduced us to Jack very well. I thought it got us caught up with exactly where we are. You know, it could have been very easy to open with Jack in Vegas. He's down on his luck. He's got his final notices piling up. And then all of a sudden, here come aliens. I like that they didn't do that. I like that it's, we're tracking. There's a crash landing. Go get them. Again, 90s trope in the early 2000s.
Late
2000s, really.
Or the late aughts. It's still early in the 2000s.
You know what I mean. 90s trope of, there's aliens, the government needs them, let's go. You didn't need to overcomplicate or overexplain anything. So I like how we got into it right away.
The only thing that I bump on is that, you know, nothing screams Vegas like Miley Cyrus, and the use of fly on the wall, I mean, that just puts a hard timestamp on this movie. That was like her second single, certainly not her biggest single. And I feel like there were just so many other songs that I know this is a kids movie, obviously, but there were just so many other songs that could have worked here. I do sort of disagree with you on Jack, though. I mean, we do get his POV very early on when he picks up Alex and brings her to, and I quote, the nut job convention. So I like that they give him a hard stance there, but I feel like all of these little asides to himself where he's talking to himself don't really develop the character. I feel like that's more because we're expecting The Rock's humor, that's where it's coming from. But it could have been a little bit more well-written to set it up. But I do like this added layer of Jack trying to get out of the mob. So you know you're going to get a little bit more of a layered subplot here. Before we move on to meeting the kids, though, I do want to talk about our first huge cameo up top. I was watching the first time we watched this, I noticed the news reporter and I was like, my gosh, she looks familiar. And I'm thinking maybe, you know, she was like on an Access Hollywood or an Entertainment Tonight or something like that. And I was like, I got to look her up. And I sort of forgot all about it. And then I sat down to watch it the second time to take my notes and I caught it. She says, Natalie Gann reporting. And I went, oh my goodness. So to the internets, I went to IMDb and I was like, all right, Meredith Salinger, where are you? Where are you? So can confirm Meredith Salinger reprises her role as Natty Gann. And I was wondering how this came about. And why she would have a cameo. And I was like, is this going to be, you know, is the director, Andy Flickman, some uber Disney fan that's going to have all of these great little, you know, 90s appearances? My guess is that they were dating or having relations or something. And that's why he put her in here. Because later on, we also get Christine Lakin, who was on Step by Step. She was Alex. And they did date on and off for a while, and they have like an ongoing history of her appearing in his films. So there you go.
What an interesting tidbit. Thank you for that. Let's talk about our introduction to Seth and Sarah. They just appear in the back of the cab. He doesn't know how they got there. They basically say, we teleported here. He obviously is not going to listen to that. What I like about it is I like their performance as aliens here, because they're not robotic. It's very easy, especially when you're thinking of a child. And The Rock later on parodies it where he's like, take me to your leader. Like, I feel like it's so easy to fall into that trap. But I actually think that this was a very nuanced performance where they would just say, Jack Bruno. Like, they never understood that you can just call him Jack. It's always Jack Bruno. Like, they towed the line very well.
The Jack Bruno thing is very funny. And I do like that they lean into the comedy of them being very literal, because they're just trying to blend in with what they think Earth is. But when you put it up against something like a Dave Bautista doing Drax, I mean, it pales in comparison. But for kid actors, I thought they were very impressive. And all of the physical demands of the role too, like they really went for it. I was pretty impressed with them.
Yeah, and I'll say this now, I think that from the moment they come on the screen to the end of the film, their chemistry with Dwayne Johnson is outstanding.
Yeah, I would agree.
I thought that was very believable. I like this initial car chase because we believe that it's the government officials that have already tracked them down. Turns out it's Mr. Wolf and his guys. I like that you kind of get thrown off track early on.
That's where it really works, where you have him trying to break out of the mob. It's just not, you know, man versus the government in this case, which is sort of what the original was. So I think that added layer really helps this along, especially when you're talking about, you know, an hour and a half long movie. You needed something else there other than a snatch and grab with these kids.
Yeah, and as much as I love Galaxy's Edge, this is one of those things that makes me miss Lights, Motors, Action. Mm. Because this screams Lights, Motors, Action to me.
The tunnel bit is very cool, but I feel like the train sort of takes it too far.
Yeah, at least later on it does, you're right. I like when we wind up at the shack where they have the underground lab. I actually think that this is a really, really well-made set. I think it's functional. I love the aesthetic of it. You could tell it's a soundstage, but in the ways that you want it to look like it's a soundstage.
Oh, absolutely. But really, I mean, there's no excuse when you're creating something like Pandora around the same time period and you get that bioluminescence and the glow. I mean, I have to imagine they employed sort of the same techniques that Joe Rohde was doing, or maybe he took from film to create that glow. But I really appreciate that it was all practical. And this is where the physical performance really blows me away too. Like with Anna Sophia Robb, there's a part where she's getting chased and she does like a tumble and lands on her feet. I was pretty impressed.
Yeah, it's so funny that you bring that up, because that was my next note, was how much practical effects there are specifically here, but throughout the entire film. And frankly, that's why the movie's 15 years old, but you could tell me, other than The Rock having aged a little bit, and he still looks great, that's not a knock, but there's a physical difference between The Rock now versus The Rock then. The Rock now is a lot bulkier, not heavier, but bulkier.
I noticed that. He looks very lean here. I mean, like, he's got, obviously, muscle mass. He's wrestling, but compared to what he is now, he looks leaner.
For sure. But you could tell me this movie came out last year, and the only reason why I wouldn't believe it is because most of it would be CGI now. But it still looks really good.
Well, the practical stuff does. Once they bust out of the shack, I think the CGI looks pretty bad, because they've got, you know, basically they blew up like the biosphere beneath, that's hidden beneath the shack. So it's shooting up out of the ground, and that didn't look so great. But that's more like bad, cheap CGI for 2009. And in some ways, it almost still looks better than some of the things that they're trying to pass off now, because VFX artists are spread far too thin.
Well, and this movie was made for $50 million. And I'm sure a majority of that went to get Dwayne Johnson. I'm sure a lot of that was his paycheck. So you think about a $50 million movie 15 years ago. Remember, this isn't a $50 million movie from like the late 90s. This is from 15 years ago. Versus something that has a $250 or $300 million budget now. I honestly think that the VFX here are better than what we're seeing nowadays.
I would agree, but when you also consider that Pirates was before this, I mean, okay, to your point, fair, much bigger budget, so they're going to have better CGI, but that was good CGI that still holds to this day. I think this could have been a little bit cleaner.
Well, be that as it may.
At least in this scene, because the other stuff, like with the articles and the opening credits, and most of the computer things that we see, you know, like when they sort of throw it up like Tony Stark does, and it's, you know, on a wall instead of in a computer or on a monitor, that all looks pretty good, I thought.
I also like the introduction to the siphon. I thought that quick shot, that quick flash of light where you see him standing over the Rock's shoulder, and then the light flashes again and he's gone. I love the look of it. It kind of has like a Tron look to it. Mysterious character, and you don't know exactly who it is yet. You don't know if this is somebody that's sent to stop them, if this is somebody that's sent to help them, because we fell into a trap for a while where assassins were like low-key good guys, and you don't find that out until much later in the film. I'm actually glad that they didn't do that here, though.
Yeah, this is kind of like a vigilante red herring. I liked it.
Yeah, and I thought a good intro. I like the escape. I like the cab is completely destroyed. The Cheech Marin cameo?
Totally unexpected. And this is what I'm talking about, right? You got Meredith Salinger. I was like, who, like, did they owe him favors? Like, how did you get this many people? But I love Cheech in this role.
For sure.
And, I mean, he's got such a long-standing relationship with Disney, too. Like, how do you not?
Yeah.
But he's a scene stealer, because this character, for as little screen time as he's got, just seems so fully developed. You know, he's trying to swindle Jack out of more money for the repairs because he's got such little time to do it. The whole thing is pretty great.
I like the scene inside. They call it the diner, and it is, but it kind of seems like a bar at the same time, because as the taxi cab is getting repaired, they go into this diner, but there's a live band. It almost seems like they're in a honky-tonk, but it's a diner. That I thought it was like, it's either a diner or it's a bar.
I mean, if you're on the outskirts of Vegas, I will totally buy this vibe for sure. And I mean, they do give us that impression, right? Because they show us how long and expensive the cab ride is. So you do know that they're pretty far removed from the city. But I do like this local law enforcement versus government showdown here. Coming off of that shack explosion, it's a good beat for comic relief where you've got the local sheriff trying to flex and tell the government that they have no jurisdiction in this bar. The only thing that I feel is sort of clunky is once they pull out all the guns, and literally pull out all the guns, there's a few cuts to people reacting to it, and then the music comes to a screeching halt. That all should have happened at the same time. And I think the reason for that, and this is something that I noticed that drove me bonkers both times that I watched it. So I guess now is as good a time as any to bring it up. I swear to you, they used two lenses to shoot this film. There are hardly any wide shots. There is maybe one establishing shot of Vegas in the beginning, and it's probably stock footage. Otherwise, we hardly have... There's like one exterior and then you are in scene with your cast. There's hardly any other cutaways to give you a feel for the setting. Like they do show the bar band singing for a beat, but by and large in this film, I feel like you never get a full scope and scale of the rooms because they don't use wide shots at all. And I think that that's supposed to lend to the style of this film and how they're trying to make it feel obviously like an action movie, but I think they're also trying to make it feel a little heisty. But it really bothered me how closed in everything felt. And this is a scene where it suffers from it because you have so many little things that you're cutting to show these reactions. Your timing is off on everything else.
But I think the distraction was great. I like their escape. I like their interaction with Junkyard.
Me too. I love Junkyard. And that is something I think that they, you know, whether they're looking to escape from Witch Mountain as the source or the book, you know, Tia did have, I think it was, is it Winky the Cat? You know, obviously it's good to give a character with telepathy something to bounce off of. And here I really like how they used it for comedy where she's saying, oh, you know, he needs to go to the bathroom. He wants a treat. I think that that was all really well done. But I like the switch here from cat to dog because I feel like they can do more with the dog.
100%. I like our return to the UFO convention, by the way, because at this point we've kind of forgotten about Alex Friedman.
There was just enough time to let her breathe, yeah.
Which was really, really smart, I felt. And you insert a little bit more comedy here. Were you abducted? I was abducted. I married an alien. I've been to a crop star. And she just...
Did you get probed?
She's so fed up with it. Like, it plays for comedy, but it also plays for... She is a disgraced astrophysicist, but she's not there to do, like, the X-Files thing. Like, she's there... quite literally to prove that there is life elsewhere. It's not meant to be done in a way that's it's not meant to be theatrical. It's not meant to be an afterthought or a joke.
You almost feel bad for her because her lecture turns on her so fast with these questions. She barely has time to explain what she captured in her photo, and then they start with all of the, no pun intended, but we'll go with it, probing questions.
Yeah.
But it does become every bit of what Jack is referring to when he calls it a nut job convention.
For sure. The one thing that I don't care for moving forward, I don't buy her and Jack as a romantic relationship.
Dude, I don't know if it's The Rock or what. Because I didn't buy him and Emily Blunt in Jungle Cruise. Like, I wish they would have just kept it, like, as a business partner's relationship. And I kind of get the same thing here. I fully buy how invested they are in these kids and helping. And I think that that's where it's sort of a natural read, because they're kind of assuming a parental role. So I guess that's where you get them sort of bouncing off of each other in that way. But I agree with you. It doesn't read romance. And I feel like, I mean, they do make it perfectly clear, because you get Sarah spelling it out. Oh, she thinks about you just as much as you think about her, because she can read everyone.
Yeah. I felt like that was just forced in there. I don't think that you needed a romance between the two of them. I don't know if it's The Rock, because I feel like you can give him a romantic counterpart in a film, but I feel like, I don't want to say that it's casting, because I love Emily Blunt, but I don't think that that type of character was out there looking for a romantic counterpart. I don't think that Alex is out there looking for a romantic counterpart. Like, I feel like the character needs to be written a certain way. And I don't see it in either of those cases.
Yeah, I mean, I do agree. I guess I wonder, do you feel like if they hadn't gone this route, do you feel like something would have been missing?
No. I don't think anything would have been missing.
I'm back and forth, because while I don't buy them, I kind of feel like you might have needed that layer. Well, here's what I think it is. And this was something that I meant to bring up earlier. As much as it works that Jack is trying to get out of the mob, we don't really know why. Other than the kids being endearing, we don't really know why he is so invested in helping them. So I feel like he needed to be developed a little bit more, because it feels like he's looking for something, but we don't know what it is. So maybe if you establish that, you know, he wants a family, or, you know, he was this ladies' man about the town in Vegas and now he's looking to settle down. You just needed a little bit more backstory there, and I think we would have found it more believable.
What I do like, and the layer that they did add here, was the invasion.
So good.
This was such a good twist, because the whole time you're thinking, okay, government, aliens, Area 51, they're here. Why? We don't know. They crash landed. Was it by accident? Like, there are just certain alien tropes. The whole notion that they are here to prevent a future invasion by saving their own planet, I went, this just took this to another level.
Such a great ad. Because a lot of the things that we bumped on, or at least that I bumped on in Escape, were we knew the kids were orphans. It explains them being orphans because they crash landed on Earth. Okay, sure. But a lot of what bothered me was that Tia's telepathy, they use that as a crutch to drive the plot. And it's like, oh, I have this vision. We need to get to this place. And then they'd go. And then there's another vision. And it just didn't work, because it was so unmotivated. Here, it creates a complete story. I love that the reason they're here trying to save their planet completely parallels our own reasons and the need to save our own planet here. And I love too that, you know, they say their parents are scientists, but their government dispelled them. And I was like, oh my God, this is like so relatable, you know, with people shooting down the whistleblowers. And I thought the whole thing was just such a great upgrade. Like, this is a reason you remake a film, to improve upon what's there.
Agreed.
They absolutely did it.
And up until this point in time, I thought the movie's been really, really well paced, getting us from point A to point B without dragging or without feeling rushed. However, it's at this point, we're a little bit more than halfway through. We're probably closer to 3/4 of the way through the movie at this point.
Yeah, because then the pace really picks up.
Oh, see, and
in
third
act.
I think there's a 15-minute time period where the pace comes to a to a dead stop.
Huh.
Because I think there's too much pursue and escape. We gotcha, escape. We gotcha again, escape. Like, you've been pursued and escaped from every setting that you were in. I didn't feel that they needed to do it additionally, but there were times where it was just like, oh, here we go again.
I will give you that one, because by the time we get to the stun darts, I was like, how is this the first time that this happened? They were so close. They could have hit these kids already. But where I do think they sort of balance it out here is with the comedy. You know, they've got this diversion to break out of the convention, which I thought was really funny because, you know, again, you've got this play of what aliens are sort of assumed to be in like the era of early sci-fi films, you know, with the tinfoil and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
It looks cheap, but it's purposefully done. So it's really funny. Then they break out of the convention and they have to go and see Alex's sort of not really a colleague, but her rival. Right. And you get this incredible bit part with Gary Marshall, who is, I mean, do I need to say it? You know, my love of Hocus Pocus. He is just so brilliant in any bit part that he does. And this is no different, because he totally, him and his team, you know, you've got the cringy one that's hitting on Alex. You know that she goes to him, tail between her legs. She doesn't want to ask for his help, but she absolutely needs to. So I think this is just such a great area where those chases do breathe a bit. And it's all done through this incredible character, which, much like Cheech Marin, very little screen time, but you do a whole lot with it.
Yeah, because not only is it a great cameo, but he's the one, because he is a conspiracy theorist, he's the one that leads them to Witch Mountain. So it was not a completely unmotivated cameo. It's not an unmotivated character. He helps with the escape, and he does help them get to where they need to be.
And escape later on, because he's driving the cab as the diversion.
Yeah, so all of that works really, really well. We get to Witch Mountain, right? What I'm impressed with in this film is their ability and their courage to really go for it.
Yes.
There are time and time and time again where they go for it. When they tell us that they're going to dissect the kids. They're going to kill him. They're going to dissect them. And there's a moment where a scientist goes, is this right? And they go, don't you want a job? And he's like, yeah. They're not afraid to put it out there when they eventually do break them out. Because there's action upon action upon action with the car chases. We know that. But when they break them out and they open fire on all of them, and the kids use their powers to literally stop the bullets in midair.
Oh, gosh. Like, yeah.
This was a very go for it kind of movie in all of the ways that you want it to be. And I really thought that this was a brave stance for Disney to take.
Yes.
Especially considering the target demographic. They would never do this today.
You can't.
But I thought that it really worked. And I think that it elevated the movie to the point where you can expand past your target demographic.
Absolutely. Even before all of that, just when they're at the base of the mountain, when they do, and you know, when they do shoot the kids with the stun darts, you do see them fall. But Alex threatens to go public with this story. And is it Brooke, the government official?
Burke.
Thank you. He says to her, go ahead. Basically, he's like, you know, everybody's going to think you're a Looney Tune. Nobody's going to believe you. And I'd rather you do that, because it's going to be worse filling out the paperwork if I have to kill you. That's where I was like, wow, this really took a dark turn. And they're at the base of the mountain at this point. They're not even inside it yet. That's a great switch too, I think, because in Escape, if memory serves, the point was to get the kids to the mountain, because that's the rendezvous point where they're kind is going to come and pick them
right.
up. Here, I love that Witch Mountain is the government cover-up. I thought that that was a pretty cool twist.
Yes. And I do like the fact that we get Winnebagos in both films. I that's not lost on me.
The only thing where I feel like Vegas might have been a miss as the setting is because, like, now that you have this whole operation inside of the mountain, like, it's begging to be Hoover Dam, you know? But, I mean, if you're thinking spaceship crash landing into a desert, like, I mean, sure, there's plenty of alien stories that take place in New Mexico, but, like, you gotta go Area 51 here.
Agreed. And I like the fact that at the end of the movie, they being Alex and Jack, go public with the story as a means of protecting themselves. So they literally do what it is that they're told. I just wanted to touch on that because, you know, like you said, that's a big line in this scene. But the fact that they actually paid off on it and they're like, well, we're doing what we're told. And hey, guess what? We're still here. We didn't disappear. I love the fact that they took that and turned it on its head and not only used it to protect themselves, but also used it to get credibility. So I like that they paid off on that line later.
I would agree, especially because they're doing so much to build Alex here too, where, you know, they find the spaceship in the mountain and there's the team of scientists around it, and she assumes the position of, I have my direct orders from Burke. And with very little planning, she's just like, I got this. She puts on the lab coat. She goes down and she's like, there's radiation in here. You need to evacuate. And everybody buys it because right. she says she has direct orders. So I like that for as much as they sort of put her down in the beginning of this film, they really gave her the agency to take it back.
Agreed. I just wish that we would have had a bigger conclusion to the siphon. I felt like this siphon has been chasing us the entire movie, and I just wish that there would have been, I mean, you know they're going to defeat him, you know that they're going to kill him, and that's all well and good, but I felt like we got to that moment and rushed through that moment. Like, we didn't, like, I would have been totally fine eliminating another pursue and chase scene so that we could give that moment a little bit more.
Especially, too, because I find it so distracting that you get the long chase where they're in the ship itself, and I sort of got distracted with, where are they flying? Are they in orbit? Because if not, everybody in Vegas can see you.
Right.
If you are in orbit, you know, Alex and Jack didn't even have that moment of hesitation of, are we going into space? Like, everything just kind of happens. And it works for the pacing because everything is just driving forward. But I do think there are some things that get lost as a result. This does look great, though.
Yeah.
The exterior of that spaceship flying and, you know, hitting into corners and crashing into things, this was really well done.
It looks great, for sure. Do you have anything else on the end of the film here, or the final act, before we move on to cast? Because I really don't have much else.
Just that the goodbye at the end was surprisingly rough. For me, we got there and, you know, obviously Jack has been so invested in these kids. We know that he's going to help them no matter what. They did even establish that when they get separated from the kids and they break out of the back of the car, you know, him and Alex have that exchange. Well, there's no exchange. They can just read each other, you know, where she was like, at what point did you know we were going to bust out of here and help them at all costs? And that's the thing. Like, Jack has just been, no matter what it is, helping these kids through. So they've done a great job of developing his relationship to them to a point where, you know, you get a little bit of a lump in your throat at the end when they realize they're going to part ways. But I do like that they gave him the pager or whatever it is that you want to call it, so you know that they'll stay in touch. I thought that that was, you know, especially in a kids movie, a good way to tie a bow on it.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about our cast here, starting with Dwayne The Rock Johnson. I really liked him in this movie. I actually think I liked him in this more than I liked him in Jungle Cruise. And I liked Jungle Cruise. I think that I was a little kinder on Jungle Cruise than you were. I've watched it a few more times since then and seem to like it more and more the more that I watch it. But I liked him here. I liked the kind of darkness that he brought early on. I believe that this is somebody that worked for the mob. But I like that he has always found, and I know that I can tell you this from having met him as a kid, when he was the Rock, okay? When he was the Rock, he was the biggest thing on the planet. I met him at a Barnes & Noble in Huntington when he was doing his book tour. And his ability to go in and out of character with you at the table, and his ability to be so gentle with you as a kid, I that stands out to me, and you see that in this movie. He has, like, such a kindness towards the kids that I feel like a lot of pro wrestlers, especially those that kind of come in and out of the heel role, I don't know that they necessarily have that restraint. He does. He is, I think, an underappreciated talent.
Oh, no doubt. He's incredible with kids. I like him in this role, but I like what he did with it because he did a lot with not a lot to work with. They needed to develop this character more through the writing. We needed more backstory. I don't really care how you got in the mob. Oh, well, no, they do say that it was NASCAR, but yeah. Why do you want to get out now? What made you have your come to Jesus moment where you want to be one of the good guys? The kids give you that redemption arc, but why do you want it? Why do you keep going back to them? We just needed a little bit more of that thread, and it would have gone a long way. But being that you didn't have it, The Rock does give that level of compassion and empathy where you buy it, but he shouldn't have had to do the heavy lifting for it.
Agreed. Carla Gugino plays Dr. Alex Friedman here. I like her. I mean, I like her. I've enjoyed her in her other films, but frankly, like, when I look at her, I think she was a little typecast here, because around the same time that this came out, she had just done Night at the Museum. But I feel like I buy her as a romantic interest more with Ben Stiller than I do with Dwayne Johnson. And I don't think that that has to do with her as an actress. I think that has to do with how those two characters were written into each of their films.
See, it's interesting that you say typecast because I feel like she's such a versatile actress. Like, I love her more in, like, a boss role, like in Entourage, but I also think that she does the mom role really well too, like in Spy Kids or Haunting of Hill House, even though she was in that for such a short time. I feel like actually this more closely resembles her role in Spy Kids because she is giving that maternal instinct, but she also proves herself to be kind of a tough cookie. And I think that that's where she shines the most. I mean, I might also be completely biased because she was in a Bon Jovi video and we all know how I feel about Bon Jovi. But I just love her and everything that she does. And I was really happy to see her here, especially because what I never realized, I think if she feels typecast anywhere, it's because she sounds so much like Courtney Cox. And with that haircut, too, if you close your eyes, you're gonna think it's Courtney Cox. And I feel like that's where this is so different from anything else that she's ever done, because I feel like she's more subdued here.
Anna Sophia Robb plays Sarah. I really like this character. I liked her performance here. To note, the only time that she doesn't call him Jack Bruno is when she says goodbye to him. You know, as you pointed out, that was something that hit hard with you at the end, was their goodbye. She was great. I love her interaction with Jack. I love her interaction with Junkyard. I like her interactions with everybody else more than with her own brother. But I feel like at times the two of them don't even communicate all that much. Telepathy. I feel like they have less of a relationship here than the siblings do in Escape to Witch Mountain, as odd as that seems, but I still thought she was really good.
I would agree. I think she really nailed the literal delivery. To your point, I think it was absolutely intentional. You know, that's her character arc, that in her time on Earth, she learned to feel. She did take away something about humans, which so does Seth, which we'll talk about in a moment. But I feel like that's where, you know, that's the message. She learned to love. That's part of it, you know, and that's why she didn't have to call him by his full name. And, you know, there's more of their relationship is more personal now. But I thought she was great in the role, and I really like what they did with the character. I like, because that was something that I was really critical about in the original, that the telepathy and hearing the voices, I didn't like how it was used as a plot device, but I also didn't like how they used it for dialogue for her to communicate with her brother. I like that we didn't necessarily have to hear any of that. And it was exposed through action here. So I think that that was a really great adjustment for this character.
Seth is played by Alexander Ludwig. I thought he was really great as well. What I liked about him most is that he learns in his time on Earth, yet he's still stoic by the end. I think for this character, it worked. I don't think you needed to soften him at all.
I would agree with that. The only thing that I bump on sometimes is I feel like he didn't handle the literal deliveries as well as Anna Sophia Robb did. And I feel like where you get that stagnant alien speak, he did it a little bit more than her. It wasn't a detriment to his performance, but I feel like it was noticeable. The physical stuff he handled great, though.
Kieran Hines plays Henry Burke, the leader of our government agency here, Project Moondust. It is so easy to just take this role and typecast it with government official, aliens, walkie-talkie, you get it. But Kieran Hines is so good and he's so talented that I actually think that casting him here was a home run.
He gave it a depth that you're not expecting, because yes, you are expecting exactly what you said. Government official, alien, stoic, you know, it sort of writes itself. But he gave it this air of he liked being the bad guy, to a point where almost when they talk about doing the experiments on these kids, it seems personal.
Yeah.
And that I wasn't expecting. So to layer your performance like that and make it so dark, it was really well done.
And we would be remiss if we didn't mention Tom Everett Scott. I love every time Tom Everett Scott pops up in a movie. He's such a nice guy in all of his movies that you don't expect him to be the one holding the gun willing to dissect the kids. So a departure for him, but it's worth mentioning.
Yeah, I feel like he didn't get enough screen time, though, you know, because he does so many bit parts. You wish they gave him a little bit more love and a couple more lines and a little bit more agency, but, you know, he's kind of a hired gun.
Yeah. Final thoughts on The Race to Witch Mountain?
I'll go first because it's pretty short and sweet. I was surprised by how much I enjoyed this. This was a remake worth doing because where they made adjustments, it really did bolster the story up. I liked the cast. I liked the humor. This was a fun watch.
I really, really enjoyed this movie a lot. More so than I thought I was going to when we sat to watch it. I think that this is a popcorn flick. I think this is, you make a bowl of popcorn, you throw yourself down on the couch when it's raining outside, and you want to just be entertained for an hour and 40 minutes. I think this is the way to go. I think the cast is great. I think the story is fun. It's straightforward. It's not overly convoluted. This is one that I not only anticipate revisiting, this is one that I am excited to revisit.
And I think what's the most surprising too is it's a good alien movie. Like, when's the last time we got one of those, you know, like Signs?
Probably.
You know, and I mean, that's different. The genre's a little bit different. It's definitely scarier. But for a sci-fi alien flick, it's good.
Yeah. But we want to know what you have to say about the Race to Witch Mountain. You can join the conversation on social media on all major platforms at Monoreal Radio, or you can shoot us an email, monorealradio@gmail.com. News of the week is coming up, but first a quick break.
News of the week is proudly sponsored by KMV Travel. KMV Travel is a boutique travel agency that helps families plan personalized vacations and create unforgettable memories on land and at sea. KMV Travel specializes in Disney destinations, family theme parks, and most major cruise lines, providing unmatched service from start to finish with the belief that vacations are an important part of life. KMV Travel will help you and your family experience new places, learn about other cultures, relax, and reconnect with those who mean most. KMV Travel will guide you from booking to bon voyage, ensuring you have the tools you need to enjoy each moment of your vacation at no extra cost to you. Visit kmvtravel.com to connect with an expert travel advisor and start planning your getaway now. So we are fresh off the Oscars this weekend. I want to talk quickly about some snubs and surprises that were not really surprises to me. Let's talk about the snubs first. Elemental was up for Best Animated Feature. Unfortunately, it did not win. We reviewed that one back in January. I don't think story-wise it was quite as strong as it needed to be, but animation-wise it was absolutely stunning. So I was kind of bummed about that one. More so bummed that Guardians of the Galaxy did not win for Best Visual Effects, because I thought that that was a lock. Granted, we didn't see Godzilla Minus One, which did win. I was just completely shocked that for Rocket alone, it got snubbed in that category. Now let's talk about the surprise. It was no surprise to me that Poor Things took home some hardware, because it's been doing consistently well throughout the award season. I didn't think it was going to take Best Picture over Oppenheimer. But, you know, it has been getting its recognition. So it wasn't a total shock that Emma Stone won. It did drop on Hulu earlier this week before the Oscar ceremony. So just a friendly reminder to check your parental settings on Hulu so that your kids don't stumble across this one. But the surprise for me was not that it won in the categories that it took home. The bigger surprise is that Disney has not even posted about it yet at the time of this recording. And I think that has a lot to do with the fact that the Disney, even though it's Marvel and Pixar, the Disney proper films didn't win in their categories. The Searchlight film is what took it. And this was an acquisition. This wasn't even really produced under the Disney banner at all. So I just thought that that was kind of interesting. To me, that's the biggest snub, that they didn't even do like an Oscars wrap-up post. And that's because it was a little thin this year.
And they knew well enough to pluck the person that was heading Searchlight and put them in charge of Disney live action, but not to the point where they're going to recognize this. But I think that a part of it is that it wasn't, as you said, quote unquote, Disney proper. I also think that, to keep this as family friendly as I can, Cruella De Vil and Bruce Banner spend half the movie in relations without clothes on, which also speaks to why Hulu shouldn't be on Disney Plus. But I think that that's why they don't want to draw attention to it, because kids that are on social media that are following Disney accounts are going to see this. They're going to recognize Emma Stone. They're going to want to watch the movie. It's not a film that's appropriate for kids. And I think that that's probably the more likely reason why. But
they have a lot more to lose with this than, you know, an actress who voices Elsa doing a concert and maybe letting a couple of F-bombs drop.
Correct. Because she's at least keeping her clothes on. Which, listen, Emma Stone's allowed to do whatever she wants. She's an extraordinarily talented actress, as, you know, she was rightfully rewarded this weekend. She cannot be married strictly to Cruella de Vil the same way Mark Ruffalo cannot exclusively be married to Bruce Banner.
They're under no obligation to represent these characters for the rest of their lives.
Correct, but because in Disney's eyes they're tied to them, they can't draw attention to this particular film.
And that's also the difference, is that you can access this particular film through Disney. If you go to an Idina Menzel concert and you purchase tickets and you hear her curse, you knew what you were buying into. Here is a whole different ballgame if a kid can just pull up this movie.
Let's talk about some vacation-related news. Starting with some development over on Castaway Cay. We talked about Castaway Cay last week as Splash celebrated its 40th anniversary, and Castaway Cay served as a setting in the film Splash. Like I said then, nobody believed that that was Cape Cod, but
Or the East River.
Correct. But we are getting some developments with Lighthouse Point over at Castaway Cay.
Yes, Lighthouse Point construction is underway, and we got a first look at what appears to be some beachside cabanas and the eateries. So those are on Disney Parks and the Disney Cruise Line's Instagram, and it looks like it's moving pretty fast.
Yeah, I mean, I would hope that the construction does move quickly with Disney introducing some new ships towards the end of this year, and I think Castaway Cay is going to see an influx of travel, so good to see that that's at least moving along. If you are a Florida resident looking to visit the parks, they have a really great deal going right now where they're calling it the Discover Disney ticket. It is exclusively for Florida residents, but on a 4-day ticket, the price drops to, I think it was under $60 a day on a 4-day park ticket, and it's good until the beginning of September. You do have to have an advanced reservation at a park to utilize it, but I think for that price to get 4 parks, if you're somebody that can't have an annual pass, maybe you are just coming for a weekend, or maybe you're going to drive up a couple of times over the course of the summer, that I think is an outstanding price.
I agree. I think it's a great way to experience the Food and Wine Festival. We usually like to do Food and Wine towards more of the back end in the fall. But if you want to get a jump on it, it starts in July. That's a great way to do a long weekend so you can experience the festival.
We also got some news out of California. Disney, as of yesterday, was approved for what is being called an expansion of Disneyland, though they're not actually expanding their physical footprint. They have $1.9 billion set aside to expand some land in Disneyland. There's talk that it could be Zootopia, it could be Arendelle, it could be anything, because they tell us things, but they don't really tell us what they're doing. All we know is that they are going to expand into an existing parking lot, and to make up the parking spaces, they have been approved in zone to build a parking garage.
Sort of like how Manhattan got to be Manhattan, right? You're out of space, so you go up, which shouldn't be a surprise because we've known that about Disneyland forever, for as long as it's been in existence. That's why, you know, Walt started with the Florida project, is because he knew he could buy a lot more land here. So you kind of knew that you're stuck with the footprint that you had, and they're doing the best they can with what they have to work with. But I also think, you know, with the way that everybody's been sort of talking box office numbers and how Disney hasn't performed well, and oh, where is this money coming from, blah 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 blah, this shouldn't be a surprise because they did announce that they were going to invest, was it $67 billion
worldwide
over the course of 10 years. That was, I believe, on an earnings call, so that's, you know, being spread across all of the parks. I'm thinking this is probably the most you are going to see with Disneyland just because of the space issue. So this is probably going to be, you know, like a one and done as far as their quote unquote expansion.
Yeah, they're very quickly going to run out of space there. And this is not something that's happening overnight because, number one, Disney. Number two, they have said this is a 4-decade long project. 4 decades. They've laid out 40 years worth of plan at Disneyland. So this is going to take a while, but it's newsworthy because this is the first time that the city of Anaheim has granted them this kind of permission since the 90s when they expanded and built DCA.
And that's why it's also going to take so long, is because pulling these permits with the city, I cannot even imagine the red tape nightmare that that is.
Yeah, well, we want to know what you have to say about this week's news. You can let us know on all major social media platforms at Monoreal Radio, or you can email us monorealradio@gmail.com. Thank you all so much for joining us this and every week on Monoreal Radio. Monoreal Radio will always be free, but there are many ways that you can help support the show. Please give us a rating wherever you listen to your podcasts. Join the conversation on social media at Monoreal Radio on all major platforms. Share your favorite episodes with family and friends who may enjoy them. And of course, book your next trip with Jackie. Links to everything can be found at monorealradio.com. We all get one story. Make yours a magical one.
On behalf of Monoreal Radio, we'd like to thank you for joining us. We'll see you at the movies, the stuff dreams are made of.